Welcome to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Coming up this hour, we'll hear from actor Richard Thomas about taking on the iconic role of Atticus Finch in To Kill a Mockingbird. Also, the latest on sun protection. But to begin, we're taking a comprehensive look at the state of abortion access in Pennsylvania. Right now, abortion is legal up to 24 weeks gestation, or later if a medical emergency necessitates the procedure. Also, Democratic Governor Wolf has issued an executive order seeking to protect out-of-state patients who travel to Pennsylvania from being prosecuted by their home states. However, much of this could change in early 2023 following the midterm elections. Pennsylvanians will elect a new governor who could decide to keep or reverse Wolf's recent executive order. The incoming governor also will have the power to veto or sign any new legislation regarding abortion in the state. And there's a constitutional amendment making its way through the legislature, which would make it easier to ban abortion in Pennsylvania. So a lot is in flux. Here in studio to help us unpack the situation is WHYY's political reporter, Katie Meyer. Hi, Katie.
Hi.
Let's begin with the executive order, which Governor Wolf issued last week. And again, the order seeks to help patients in states which restrict or ban abortion. Tell us more about the protections offered.
Yeah, so this is really Wolf just using his own power to the extent that he's able to without the legislature. So I'll preface just by saying some states that don't have, you know, restrictions on abortion like others have passed after the overturn of Roe. Some states have like legislatively passed bills that say, you know, we will not, you know, help other states enforce their restrictive abortion laws. Pennsylvania cannot do that because their legislature is controlled by Republicans who just don't support that. So what Wolf has done is basically he bars any state agency or board or commission, basically anyone that answers to the governor, from using state resources to help another state investigate somebody who gets an abortion in Pennsylvania from that state, detain people who get abortions or, you know, help with them. Basically, he's saying, you know, we're not going to help other states with these restrictive laws enforce their laws if someone comes to Pennsylvania to get an abortion. That's really what it is. Also, Wolf is, you know, he's denying any request to arrest or extradite people who get an abortion here. And he's instructing state agencies to kind of do some work to figure out how to protect Pennsylvania providers who might, you know, perform an abortion and then face legal action from a different state. So really covering the bases again, but this is only for people who rely on state funding. So there are some limits.
Okay. Regardless, the fate of this executive order lies in the hands of the next person to occupy the governor's residence, Katie?
Yes. This is, I think, something that, you know, is important to remember just in general about Pennsylvania and abortion. We are in a kind of weird position because so much rests on who the governor is. It's a delicate situation for Pennsylvania's current abortion rights, as you said, up to 24 weeks gestation, and then after if there's like a medical emergency. So if, for example, Doug Mastriano, who's the GOP candidate for governor, wins in November, then we would be looking at an end, absolutely, to this executive order and also probably down the road some additional restrictions.
All right. And State Attorney General Josh Shapiro, who's running on the Democratic side, would support essentially what Wolf has done.
Yeah. So just kind of set up what the two candidates believe on abortion, because this is one of those issues where, like, there's a really, really clear difference and you're pretty much guaranteed to see different outcomes based on who the governor is. So Josh Shapiro, the Democratic nominee, basically supports the status quo. I've talked to his campaign a bunch about this. They say, you know, we don't want to, like, change the current law. We just want to keep it the way that it is. Doug Mastriano, he supports pretty much the most restrictive abortion laws that you can support. One of the first bills that he sponsored when he got into the Senate a couple years ago was a 6-week abortion ban. That's before most people know that they're pregnant. And so he has also said that he doesn't support exceptions for rape, incest, if the parent's life is at risk. And during a debate, I mean, this was like very... It was very clear, you know, like he was very definitive about this position. He said, you know, Kathy Barnett, who was running for Senate at the time, she was a product of rape. And he kind of used that as an example of like, so it's actually OK for people to be, you know, forced to carry pregnancies to term in those cases. Anyway, what Mastriano can do as governor, of course, is going to be dictated by the legislature and how far they're willing to go. And we can get into that because it does get complicated politically for some of these members.
Top of the news here, the constitutional amendment, the proposed amendment, which has won initial approval in the General Assembly. What would it do, Katie?
So this is kind of a way for the Republicans who control the House and the Senate right now to clear a path for some kind of restriction in the future, and also to make sure that Pennsylvania's current norm where Medicaid dollars can't be used for abortion, state dollars can't be used for abortion, they want to keep that status quo.
Okay.
So that's a big part of this. It says you can't, it would say, like, add a provision to the Constitution saying there is no right to use state dollars for an abortion, and also there is no right to have an abortion.
Okay.
So that's very, very broad.
Does it specifically ban abortion, though?
No. So this is why I say it's kind of a preparatory thing. So if this constitutional amendment passes, I'll just, again, preface all of this by saying in Pennsylvania, constitutional amendments have to pass with identical language in two consecutive legislative sessions, and the legislative sessions are each 2 years. So the sooner, and then they go to the ballot for a statewide referendum, so then every Pennsylvanian can vote on it. The soonest it could go for that statewide vote is spring of 2023, which I'll just note is like an off-year election when there's usually very, very low turnout, and those elections tend to be better for Republicans. So that's not like a coincidence that that's when that is going to probably come up. But anyway, yes, so this is basically a way, if it passes, of preparing for a potential future restriction of abortion in state law, like in an actual bill, because what this would do is it would make it impossible to contest any of those restrictions based on the state constitution.
Yeah.
So now Roe has overturned the federal, protection that was kind of assumed under federal law. That's gone.
Yeah.
But now in state law, this would also preempt any argument, any similar argument that you could make.
And the governor cannot use his veto pen.
The governor has nothing to do with a constitutional amendment. Yeah. The governor cannot stop it.
Okay. Could the amendment potentially impact things other than abortion, Katie?
Yes. So this is where it gets kind of tricky. Because it's like written pretty, pretty broadly. I've talked to the ACLU about this. They say it could regulate things like IVF treatment, contraception, IUDs, anything that could like affect an embryo or a fetus. These things, yes, absolutely could be like, you know, interpreted to be covered under this. It could also, you know, treatment for ectopic pregnancies, which aren't viable, but do require an abortion to, you know, deal with them. Often people can like get really sick or die if that's not done. But again, this is all because it's pretty broad language. It could fall under that category.
As you reported for WHYY, Katie, crowds of protesters could be heard in the background of committee meetings as this constitutional amendment wound its way through the legislative process recently. Mm-hmm. Is there a sense that abortion will become a rallying point for Democrats who've been widely expected to lose ground in federal and state races in midterm elections? What are you sensing as a political reporter here?
It is an interesting question. Yeah, I think Democrats certainly have, you know, pointed out that there's this very, very clear decision now, especially in the governor's race, because the governor has so much power over abortion in Pennsylvania. I think there is this sense of like, you know, do voters really, really care about this? And looking at polls, too, we've been, you know, pollsters in Pennsylvania have been polling this issue for decades and have seen kind of over and over again that people tend to be a little bit in the middle on abortion. They don't support, you know, making it legal under all circumstances, but they also don't support making it illegal in all circumstances. And so you've seen Democrats really try to harp, you know, Mastriano is willing to really make abortion almost impossible to get. And so absolutely that's going to be it's just going to be a big thing in this election.
What do Democrats need to do to forestall a second passage by the General Assembly of the constitutional amendment regarding abortion?
They need to win more seats in the House and Senate. That's really all that they can do. As you mentioned, you know, this is expected to be a pretty tough year for Democrats. And this is just people like kind of, you know, expecting things based on political wins. So if there's an election, the midterm election after a new president takes office, it's usually a worse year for that president's party, especially if the president has bad approval ratings like Joe Biden does. There's a lot of knock-on effects down ballot. Now, that is not set in stone, obviously. But yeah, Democrats are in the minority in the House and Senate. I will say there's one other X factor here, which is that redistricting just happened in the state and in the state House and Senate. And so Democrats actually gave themselves a much friendlier map in especially the state House. Senate kind of less so. But in the House, there's a real open question of, you know, how if they can actually gain some seats. It would have to be a bunch, like kind of unlikely that they would actually win the majority. But it's not totally impossible. So that's a real kind of wait and see situation. But if they can flip a chamber or even come really close, then that might change the odds for this amendment.
At the same time, Katie, there's a huge case before Pennsylvania's state Supreme Court called Allegheny Reproductive Health Center versus Pennsylvania Department of Human Resources. Mm-hmm. Again, the state does not allow Medicaid funds to cover abortion, and the lawsuit challenges this ban on funding. But there's also an angle involving the state constitution in this lawsuit. What are the plaintiffs saying here?
Yeah, so I had mentioned that the constitutional amendment was this attempt to enshrine within the state constitution, make it clear that there's no right to an abortion. That's actually a response to this case, which has been in the works since like 2019. And what the case is arguing, Pennsylvania has this thing called the Equal Rights Amendment, which basically says, you know, you can't deny someone the equality of their rights based on sex. And the argument really is just that, you know, if you deny an abortion, that's denying autonomy based on your sex because, you know, women can get pregnant. People with female bodies at birth can get pregnant. And they're arguing, well, that's, you know, based on sex discrimination. And so it remains to be seen what the Supreme Court would do with that, if they would have like a very, very narrow ruling on it, or if, you know,
it is Democrat majority.
It is a Democratic majority Supreme Court. Yep. In the past, they've kind of kept it really narrow, but this specific court hasn't heard this before. So it'll be interesting to see what they do. They're expected to take it up this year. We don't know exactly when yet.
Ironically, Governor Wolf is a defendant in this lawsuit.
That happens a lot with lawsuits that are sort of contesting existing state policy. So like Wolf ends up in a position where he's actually defending things he doesn't agree with a lot of the time.
Yeah. One more quick question for you, and this is kind of aside from the abortion issue. As you reported last week, Katie, Attorney General Josh Shapiro has won the endorsement of the Philly Firefighters Union in his run for governor. Mm-hmm. Significant turnaround from the union's most recent endorsements?
Yeah.
What's going on here?
It is interesting. So the union, in the past couple of elections, they endorsed Donald Trump. They did kind of a funny thing in the Senate race where they endorsed in the Democratic and Republican primaries. So they endorsed Connor Lamb in the Democratic primary and then Kathy Barnett in the Republican primary, who's very right wing. Both of them lost. And talking to these the firefighters union, because they do these endorsements based on a vote of the executive committee, they basically said Josh Shapiro has been around, has been kind of like talking to the firefighters union for decades since he's been in the legislature. And also he would preserve these kind of controversial bargaining rights that they have. So that's what that is.
Yeah. Lots going on. I'm sure we'll catch up soon.
Absolutely.
WHYY's political reporter, Katie Meyer. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up on the regional roundup, we'll discuss the sun, skin care, and our health with dermatologist Dr. Christina Lee Chung. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. As a wave of heat hits the Delaware Valley this week, many of us will head to the pool or beach for relief, hopefully slathered in sunscreen. Experts say sun protection is a must, no matter a person's skin tone. And they say it's important to remember some sunscreens are better at preventing sunburn and lowering cancer risk than others. Not all sunscreens work effectively, and some might contain questionable chemical compounds. To make things even more challenging, there are a huge number of products to choose from. So, where to begin? We're going to talk about the full range of sun protection right now and the signs of skin cancer as we take your calls and comments at 888-477-9499. Send us an email to radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Our guest is Dr. Christina Lee Chung, a board-certified dermatologist who specializes in skin cancer at Schweiger Dermatology Group, and she joins us in studio. Welcome.
Hi, Mary. Thanks for having me this morning.
Great to have you with us. An important topic, timely topic. We've known for years, Christina, that it's important to slather on the sunscreen, but now we're learning it's also important to do some serious shopping as a consumer in order to buy a worthwhile product. What makes some sunscreens more effective than others?
So, you know, when you talk about efficacy, it's really a complex, multifactorial kind of landscape when it comes to sunscreen. So when you talk about efficacy, we can talk about ingredients, we can talk about vehicles, we can talk about just simple use, we could talk about ease of use. So, you know, there are two main types of sunscreens when it comes to the ingredients. There are chemical sunscreens and there are mineral sunscreens. So the way mineral sunscreens work, that's traditionally your zinc and titanium-based products. What mineral sunscreens do is they kind of sit on top of your skin and they create a physical barrier. If you think, I mean, you learn in grade school that zinc and titanium are, you know, they're elements. And so if they lay on top of your skin, they create a barrier between your skin and the sun. Chemical sunscreens are created so to absorb the sun's rays, right? So there are, you know, wavelengths of light and, you know, UVA, UVB light, they reach your skin and they're the ones that cause, you know, DNA damage and, you know, all the effects that ultraviolet radiation can have. The chemical sunscreens actually are formulated to absorb those rays. And so there are pros and cons to both types of, you know, ingredients. Overall, it does seem as though the mineral sunscreens perform slightly more poorly than the chemical sunscreens.
Okay.
When tested, when it comes to protecting your skin.
Interesting. And the mineral sunscreens also leave a nice white paste.
Yes, sometimes they can leave a very nice white shiny sheen.
Interesting look, sure. But with the chemical sunscreens, the concern right now is that some of them might contain compounds that are not necessarily good for us. For instance, something called, I think it's oxybenzone. I understand a number of manufacturers are dropping this compound. Tell us about that.
So the concern with oxybenzone is that, you know, if absorbed in large quantities, there is the potential for some hormonal imbalances to occur within the endocrine system. And that's probably the biggest concern and the one thing that most people will read, a consumer will read in terms of efficacy and safety for the chemical sunscreens and oxybenzone in particular.
And also some chemicals are not necessarily good for the environment, frankly.
Yes. So, you know, being reef friendly and, you know, environmentally friendly has been kind of a big topic these days, as it should be. And so, yes, you know, this is something that consumers will read a lot about as well, is how environmentally friendly are the chemicals in your sunscreen.
So what's a consumer to do when they're shopping for sunscreens in terms of finding, you know, the blend that has ingredients that are as safe as possible and, you know, not only for humans, but for the environment as well?
So that's a loaded question. You know, there's so much data and research out there. And then with all data and research, there's interpretation, right? And then there is application and clinical relevancy. And then there's the next step of how, you know, media and, you know, marketing and advertising puts out, you know, what all of this means to the consumer. And I think it makes it very hard for the consumer because they're just on the receiving end of kind of like a whisper down the lane. And so it's I think the most important thing to discuss is, you know, what is the clinical ramification and how, you know, and should any of these studies and these concerns affect your decision making? You know, I think that's probably the most important question for a consumer to ask themselves. So in terms of the chemical sunscreens, yes, there have been studies that show that they can be absorbed and they can be found in the bloodstream. I think there are a few things that people need to remember when we're talking about these studies. One, a lot of studies are done, first of all, in a very controlled environment. Right, the recommended amount of sunscreen you put on is 2 milligrams per centimeter, and so a lot of these studies have a certain amount of sunscreen that a subject is putting all over their body, you know, or up to 75% of their body multiple times a day. A lot of these absorption results come from kind of real life conditions that wouldn't be replicated in real life. So I think everybody needs to take kind of the chemical sunscreens with a grain of salt, you know, because in real life, we don't know how much of it is being absorbed. Right. In real life, we don't really know what it means if, you know, there are high levels in your bloodstream. Population studies have not shown that like the areas where people use a lot of these chemical sunscreens, that there are higher rates of infertility or poor outcomes.
Okay.
And it's hard because some of these chemicals are found in other, you know, other products and substances that we come into contact with every day. So we don't know if some of these studies are measuring, you know, exposure to those. So when looking for a sunscreen, honestly, what most people say is if you want to bring it down to the bare minimum, find something that you like, find something that you're going to use, because the biggest barrier is people using sunscreen and finding what they like. Would I say yes? Should you be a little bit more concerned if you are pregnant or are looking for sunscreen for your children? Yes, be a little more vigilant. You know, maybe stick with the sunscreens that aren't absorbed and aren't chemicals. But I think the number one thing that consumers need to realize when you're standing in front of an aisle with hundreds of sunscreens with all of these marketing taglines is, what are you going to use?
Does the FDA weigh in on any of this?
You know, I don't know if the FDA makes a recommendation, you know.
I haven't seen it.
So the FDA doesn't really make a recommendation. I know the American Academy of Dermatology is a very big proponent of use your sunscreen, you know.
And do we use our sunscreen properly? My understanding is most of us don't use enough of it when we apply and perhaps forget to reapply when we should. Is that the case?
In my experience, in my 20 years of experience as a dermatologist, the answer to that is no. No one uses it properly.
What should we be doing?
So I usually counsel my patients that first of all, you should be using sunscreen every day. You know, the biggest fallacy is, oh, I got so burned at the ball game because there was no sun. And, you know, how much sun you're seeing and how much UV rays are getting to your skin has literally nothing to do with the weather or the climate. So everybody assumes you can't see the sun, so the rays aren't getting to me. But even if you can't see the sun on a radiant, cloudy day, 80% of the rays are getting through. And so it is visually difficult, I think, for people to understand this. But that's the biggest thing. Wear your sunscreen every day. It doesn't matter what the weather is or what season of the year it is.
Or even if we're just going to the grocery store for a quick trip outside, I mean,
yes,
in the dead of winter.
Yes, because I don't think people also realize that sun exposure is cumulative. So some people say, oh, I live in my house and I work at home, but do you go to the grocery store? Do you get your mail? Do you go for a walk? Do you walk your dog? If you think about that over a lifetime, over an 80-year lifespan, those 5-minute, 10-minute, 30-minute increments, they do add up. So all things being equivalent, if someone works at home and has very little sun exposure, if someone works outside, you still are at risk for getting sunscreen. Your cumulative sun exposure won't reach a threshold amount until probably later on. But you will get that.
Christina, a mistake many of us make is to apply sunscreen when we're already at the pool or the beach. How early should we apply? How often? How much?
So I generally recommend you need to put a good thick layer on before you leave. This is the important thing, I think, especially for summer. When you go to the beach or the pool, what I do with my family is I get everybody ready and I slather them once with a thick lotion or cream sunscreen. You want to create kind of that that protective barrier, that first layer. And then at least 30 minutes before you go out. And then pretty much what I counsel all of my patients, and my kids are really, really good about this because you teach them from the time that they're little. Your sunscreen is not there. It doesn't matter if you're in the pool or the beach or walking outside, none of your sunscreen that you put on at first is there in 2 hours. And if you are in a pool, if you're at the beach, if you're sweating a lot, exercising, engaging in sporting activities, your sunscreen is likely not there after 45 minutes. So, you know, get there, first layer, get there. And then depending on what your activity level is, make sure you take a break. When you take a water break, you know, towel off, reapply. And it doesn't, what I tell my patients is it doesn't matter what you reapply with. If you hate putting sticky paste on top of a sweaty body, then if you have to use a spray, use a spray. Half of it may fly somewhere else into the world. But at least you got some of it.
Just get it on there.
Just get it on there.
What are your thoughts about clothing that's marketed to offer sun protection? And it's called, the guide is UPF, Ultraviolet Protection Factor.
So I think that sun protective clothing is extremely important. I think that there are different textiles that will protect you more from the sun. The UPF, well, anything that has a tighter weave is going to protect you a lot more, right? Anything that's been tested, I think, obviously, is something that you should, that's the easiest way for consumers to have kind of a guideline from which to go from. But if you find yourself at the pool and you forgot to get yourself a UPF, you know, sun shirt or something, just remember, any article of clothing will be a barrier between you and the sun. I can't stress that enough, that sun protection is multifactorial. It's not just your sunscreen. And having that extra barrier is, you know, whether it's a long sleeve cotton shirt or a UPF like sun shirt, having something on really makes a really big difference. And just remember that if you can hold it up to the light and it's cotton and linen, you can see through it, it does a little worse of a job than something that you hold up to the sun and you can't see through it.
I've read, Christina, that you are an expert in cutaneous oncology, mm-hmm. The practice of recognizing skin cancer early and preventing, treating, and understanding the science behind it. True that the most common cancer in the United States is skin cancer?
Basal cell carcinoma is the most common skin cancer found in the United States. Yep.
Okay. Well, what does too much sun or sunburn then do to the skin to make it more susceptible to developing skin cancer?
So what happens is that, you know, I love this one quote that we always say, that tanning and your skin changing color, whether it's pink or brown in the sun, that is a physical sign that your skin cells are being damaged by UV rays, right? So the UV rays damage, right? They damage your skin cells, right? And what happens is it causes them to proliferate, become a neoplastic process, you know, and that's how they create a cancer. You know, a cancer is a neoplastic process where you have unchecked growth you know, aberrant growth of cells, mm-hmm. right? And so that's what the sun does. That's what the UV rays do. And your indication that that process is happening to your skin cells is your skin changing color, whether it's pink or brown in the sun.
And the most serious form of skin cancer is melanoma. Tell us about that, and also let's talk about the signs that you might be developing any type of skin cancer.
So melanoma is the most common and most common deadly form of skin cancer. Absolutely, it is. Absolutely a part of it, and development is part of it is related to sun exposure. Melanoma is interesting because, you know, there are other factors that go into kind of your risk of melanoma. There are two other skin cancers, squamous cell carcinoma and basal cell carcinoma, that are so much more commonly seen. Those really mostly are directly correlated to sun exposure, whereas melanoma has more of a genetic component, has a little bit more of a, you know, a little more complex etiology. But, you know, the studies have shown that, you know, regular sunscreen use and improved sunscreen use could prevent up to almost 800, you know, 1,000 melanoma diagnoses by the year 2031 in the United States.
Wow.
Yeah. And so melanoma is the one that is a little bit is more concerning, because based on what stage it is, the outcome is significantly worse, and it can metastasize, and it has much higher rates.
So what should we look for?
So melanomas, you know, it's generally speaking, melanomas are come from moles. That's the easiest way to put it. So what you should be looking for is a new mole. You should be looking at moles that are changing. I think it's important for everybody not to be obsessively check your skin every day, but, you know, once a month or so, give yourself a quick once over. You'll know if something looks strange to you, bring that to your dermatologist's attention. We also like to say, you know what your largest mole is and your darkest mole is, and you don't want any of your moles to get larger than your largest mole or darker than your darkest mole. You want them to be symmetrical, right? And one color. And if you have, so it's the ABCDEs. Yeah. If you have anything that looks a little bit, you know, concerning to you, definitely get it checked out, because there are a lot of other things that you can mistake things for.
People of color tend to have more melanin in their skin, which can be protective, but sunscreen is really important for everybody.
Yes. So people of color have more melanin. You know, it sits on top of, like, you know, your nuclei, and it protects your skin from the sun. But they absolutely can get skin cancer. They get significantly lower rates of sun-induced skin cancer. They do get skin cancer in other locations from different reasons. That could be a whole other episode that we could talk about. But it is important because, you know, sun exposure is not just about skin cancer. You know, it's about aging. It's about wrinkling. It's about the fact that, you know, you could be taking medications like antibiotics and water pills that can make you more sensitive to sunburns and sun poisoning. And also there are some conditions, you know, lupus, dermatomyositis, connective tissue disease, that make you more susceptible to the sun and can be triggered by the sun. So even if you don't have really fair skin, even if you've never been burned in your life, I always say this, if you care about what you look like as you get older, you should be wearing sunscreen
every day. Most of us
do.
Yes. So Christina, we've been talking about all, you know, the bad side effects of the sun, but we know that, you know, vitamin D is important to our health. Many people take a supplement. You can also, you know, get it from exposure, or not get it, but develop it, I guess, you know, from exposure to sun. How do we balance sun exposure so that we do get adequate vitamin D, but not too much sun exposure?
So I think that this is where people go a little bit astray. It doesn't take very much sun to get as much vitamin D as you need for the day. You could spend about a half hour out there and be more than fine. But, you know, there are other factors that go into your vitamin D level. So what we like to say is, you know, protect yourself from the sun. Make sure you wear sunscreen. If you're concerned, take a supplement.
Yeah. Okay. Are there certain times of the day where it's you know, I know you want us to wear sun protection, you know, all day, but certain times of the day where the sun is less damaging than others.
So I think the textbook answer is you should stay out of the sun between between 10 a.m. and 4 p.m. That is really hard for most people, especially if you're trying to have a good time on vacation.
In the summer, sure, yes. Especially.
Yes. It's like, you know, it's like you don't, you're telling people not to have any fun at all outside. So I generally, you know, I like to stay out of the sun midday. So the 12 to 3 range is kind of when the sun is the strongest. If I'm going to be out there going for a run or, you know, doing something that's going to take hours outside, I generally like to do it early in the morning or maybe later, you know, 4, 5, 6 o'clock. But does it absolve you from using sunscreen?
Well, thank you for that, Dr. Christina Lee Chung. Thank you so much for the information. She's a dermatologist specializing in skin cancer at Schweiger Dermatology Group. Great to have you with us.
Thanks a lot, Mary.
Right, take care. Up next on the Regional Roundup, we speak to actor Richard Thomas, who stars as Atticus Finch in Aaron Sorkin's adaptation of To Kill a Mockingbird, now at the Academy of Music in Philadelphia. Stay tuned.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. To Kill a Mockingbird is a cherished and controversial tale of the American South in the 1930s. Harper Lee won a Pulitzer Prize for her coming-of-age story about a young girl named Scout, whose father, Atticus Finch, is a lawyer defending a black man wrongly accused of raping a white woman. This is at the height of Jim Crow, so the defendant, Tom Robinson, stands little chance of acquittal despite his innocence. Lee's story was penned in 1960, and the recent stage production of To Kill a Mockingbird, written by playwright Aaron Sorkin, views the narrative through a decidedly modern lens. Atticus, played by actor Richard Thomas, is not a pillar of perfection, and Mockingbird's black characters are rendered a more robust and thorough portrayal than in the original. The production is now on tour and being staged at the Academy of Music in Philadelphia. Let's take a quick listen.
When I was a boy, my father gave me one of those air rifles. An air rifle. He said I could shoot all the Blue Jays I want, probably knowing I'd never be able to hit one. But to always remember that it was a sin to kill a mockingbird. A sin. A crime against God. I asked him why. And he said it was because they were innocent.
And for the rest of the hour, we are pleased to be joined by Emmy Award-winning actor Richard Thomas, who we just heard in the role of Atticus Finch. Welcome. So nice to have you with us.
Thank you. It's nice to be with you.
So, Richard, when you were first approached about doing this role, what were your immediate thoughts about tackling an iconic, beloved, and somewhat refashioned portrayal of Atticus?
I knew the show was being developed for New York. You know, Jeff Daniels, and you know that Aaron had adapted it, and Bart was directing it, Bart Scheer, and so it was of interest to everyone. And I thought, I love the road, and I knew it, there'd be a tour at some point. So when I was poised, and when the invitation came, I was very excited and happy to join. Because I think it's not only a wonderful adaptation, but it's a great time to bring this play around the country. And I mean, it's always a joy to bring a play from state to state, from city to city, and population to population. But this particular piece, I think it just couldn't be more timely.
Yeah. Well, in Sorkin's adaptation, the Black characters, again, they have more of a presence and a voice. And Atticus himself is not perfect. He's a flawed man. Many of us coming up were steeped in the original story by Harper Lee. How did you come to embrace Sorkin's version? Was it challenging? Well, did it just feel right? What are your thoughts?
Well, you know, it's a drama. So everyone has to have a story. And people have said, well, what is it like to play this icon, Atticus Finch? And of course you can't play an icon. Icons are unplayable. You can only play people. And what Aaron has done by sort of taking him off the pedestal is to give him a story of loss of innocence, which is parallel to the loss of innocence that the kids experience in the course of the play. And so it gives the actor a story to tell and an experience to have, which allows the audience to come into the play and to have more intimacy with the experience of the play. So it's a service not only to the subject matter, but certainly for the actor playing the role. And this is true of all the characters, because he's a wonderful writer and there's great humanity and great feeling in the roles, as well as the usual Sorkin dialectic, which keeps it, you know, intellectually fascinating and exciting.
Did you go back to Harper Lee's book at all as you were developing your characterization of Atticus?
Well, of course, I reread it, and I hadn't read it since I was quite young, and it was a rich experience, and it made me realize that for people who just read this book in middle school, when young people are starting to develop a real social conscience, which is the perfect time to read it the first time. If you haven't read it since you were a kid, read it again. It's a very powerful experience to read it as an adult. So I was kind of enriched by that just as a reading experience.
Sure.
And then, of course, I put it aside and didn't think about it again, because my job was to enter the world of Aaron's To Kill a Mockingbird and to find the Atticus that he put on the page, which was, you know, not that hard to do, because he's such a wonderful writer and the language is beautiful. And it's because of the cadence and rhythm and the language, the diction of it. It's a very, very large part, but it was an easy one to learn. So it was just a very exciting experience.
When you speak of Sorkin's version of Atticus Finch and you talk about Atticus's loss of innocence, what did that entail?
In so many ways, the original material and certainly the play, and the reason I believe that the material remains evergreen for us as Americans, is that it talks about the distance between our aspirations and the reality of what we achieve. You know, we aspire to be this as a country and as people. We aspire to do good. We aspire to be right. And we and we fall short. And the question is, do we then become cynical, or do we continue to aspire and strive, knowing that we may never achieve the absolute perfection we want? And I think this is not just an American story, but in terms of racial justice, it's certainly our story. And, you know, Atticus is a man who wants to believe in the goodness of all, the essential goodness of all people and in his community. And in the course of the play, you know, he comes to understand that you have to constitute your own community while still maintaining a sense of acceptance of the community at large. So he does, you know, he realizes that his idealism is not sufficient necessarily to the circumstances, and he has to figure out how to deal with the reality of his feelings without losing his idealism or his aspiration.
Richard Thomas, a theater production strikes me as almost a living being, and so perhaps subject to changes or shifts in nuance from day to day or night to night. I was going to say, does that ring true? And I guess it does. So do you find your interpretation of Atticus developing as you go along?
Well, of course, it is a living experience, which is why theater is so rich for the practitioners as well as the, you know, the audience. When you have a good text, a beautiful text, a strong text, and a company comes together to play it over a period of time, you're basically doing a communal close reading, and the more you examine it, the more you perform the ritual of the play, the more insights can come to you, more connections you can discover, and so it is a process. And the challenge is to allow that process of deepening and widening to occur without letting the play lose its essential pace and shape and style. So you have to keep it between the lines, but within that container, there's much to explore, and a lot reveals itself over time. Things that you can't know when you first are in rehearsal or first in previews. You know, you have the rehearsal period, which is the initial period of exploration and making choices and putting the show together physically and learning to be a company. And then you have the preview period, the early period, where you're first confronting your audience. Yeah. And you're just trying to get it right, and you're using your choices to sort of get you through. And then as you play over time, it's like letting go of the edge of the pool and drifting out into the deep end. You know, you begin, you're free to listen and to look and to learn things that you can't learn when you're in the early aspect of the part of the learning process.
Describe some of the changes, if you would, in some of the characters as, you know, compared to Lee's original rendering and Sorkin's redevelopment. For instance, the young people, there are no child actors in this production, correct?
That's correct. I think one of the great things about what Aaron has done is that he's in casting Jem, Scout, and Dill, the three kids, with young adult actors. I mean, they're all adults, but they're, you know, they're not an adult like I'm an adult. They're not old.
Older.
Young, mature actors. I don't know how to say it. Is that, first of all, first and foremost, he's created a uniquely theatrical experience. When you meet these young people and you realize that they are adults remembering being children, so that they are adults and children at the same time, you're in a world of theater that could only be theater. So he, by creating that convention, he's immediately made the play a purely theatrical experience and an experience of memory. And it's very beautiful, all that. I think he's, you know, I mean, Scout and Jem are both very rich characters in the novel. They're still deeply, deeply rich, but also he's giving them the lens of memory. He's allowed them to act as adults as well. And Dill is just a deliciously expanded and wonderful character in this production. You know, Tom Robinson is very, I mean, not only magnificently played by Diego Welsh, but is, you know, a very fully felt and richly nuanced and deeply painted character. And Calpurnia And the relationship between Calpurnia and Atticus, as you know, the people raising these children together in this home, really has come to the center of the play and moved to the center of the play and is aspirational in terms of the way things can be in terms of relationships between people. So, you know, and, you know, Jacqueline Williams is magnificent and luminous in the part of Calpurnia, and that relationship has really been fully invested in the play.
Let's get to some of the nuts and bolts of performing, Richard. You've been working as an actor since you were a child. Do you still get butterflies before you walk out on that stage?
Well, you know, yeah, because butterflies go through, you know, butterflies age and change just the way we do. I mean, when you're you get ready to, I mean, obviously not to the same degree as when I was a young actor. It's less of an agitating experience for me. It's a much more calm and relaxed experience. But when you're first getting out to that, when you're doing that first run through with the company, there is anxiety. It's performance. And then when you there's that first preview, there it is again, because it's performance. It's like running a race. You know, I no matter how many races an athlete runs, when it's time to get ready to hear the gun go off, you know, you're going to have a certain set of feelings, because you have to have the adrenaline, and then you have to move into performance energy and performance mode. And those butterflies, that feeling of anticipation, which is really what I feel it is now in my life, is it's your launching pad. It's the fuel. It's your rocket fuel. It's your, you know, it's the initial jet that's going to get you out there and start you moving.
So, and as a stage actor, everything's, you know, it's live, of course. You've got to be able to improvise if something doesn't work out according to script. Any memorable moments from your extensive body of work that come to mind? We've got to use that rocket fuel to get through it.
You know, I mean, I've never had anything absolutely crazy happen. I mean, you can be late for a line, you can be slightly late for an entrance, you can forget a line, you can move, you know, and these things feel monumental when they happen.
Sure.
And you have to practice instant forgiveness, I like to call it, so that you can move on. And what's really interesting in the context of making our mistakes, which of course we do, is how the company holds each other. The company will help, you know, will move to the next line, or your scene partner will understand what's happening. And it's a collective survival experience, basically survival is what it is. And performance personality has so much to do. I mean, they used to think, oh, it's all about extroversion and all that, which is, of course, not the case. It really has to do with solving problems moment to moment and improvisation, not like we're making the play up, but that we're contending with the circumstances that present themselves to us moment by moment. That's like driving a car. You know your way home, you know the street you're supposed to be on, but you still got to look in your rearview mirror, and you still got to watch out for pedestrians, and things can get in front of you, and things can happen that, you know, you're still on the same trajectory, but you have to make moment to moment decisions. And it's the same thing when you're on stage.
Yeah. And I do love the concept of instant forgiveness. Is that what you said?
It's instant forgiveness. You got to move on. You got to say, okay, that happened, I'm moving on.
Taking that one with me, Richard.
Because a mistake like that has a half-life. You know, you get that shot of adrenaline from making a mistake, and that stays with you. You have to be sure that it doesn't distort, you know, what you're going to do in the next moment.
Sure. Well, listen, we can't finish this interview without talking about the role which rocketed you to worldwide stardom, that of John Boy Walton of the Waltons, for which you won an Emmy. As an actor, Richard Thomas, how does landing that sort of role, one which, you know, becomes part of American TV lore, impact you personally and professionally?
Well, it impacts you professionally, because if it's a success, you know, that's the engine, that's the train that's going to get you to the next station. And certainly something like the Waltons, and in those days, you know, there were three networks. So when you had a hit show on television, everybody was watching it. And it was, I still can't believe that 50 years, this is the 50th year, 50th anniversary of the first episode of that show.
That's unbelievable.
50 years later, it remains so, so much a part of people's memory, and it still airs and it's still on. It's crazy. I mean, you never would imagine that. So it did more for me than anything else could possibly have done in terms of giving me agency as a performer to move forward in my career. And personally, because it was such a wonderful role and it was such a beautifully written series with such good actors, it was a way to gain success and be creatively and artistically satisfied at the same time, which was enormously important personally.
Well, we've only got about 20 seconds left. Back to Mockingbird. What would you like theater growers to take away from this production?
Well, I'd like them to be entertained. I'd like them to find the humor in the play, which he has put there in a delicious way. And I would like them to come forward with a greater enhanced sense of empathy and compassion, which I think theater at its best is an empathy machine. And that's what I'd like for us to be able to do.
Well, Richard Thomas, what a pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Richard Thomas stars as Atticus Finch in the production of To Kill a Mockingbird at the Academy of Music in Philadelphia, and that is through July 24th. As always, you can find today's show at whyy.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Our producer is Paige Marie Bessler. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks for listening. Have a great day and be well.